The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Whatever. Good morning, everybody. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis this week. Gary Mello, Jordan Heath Rawlings with me as we talk about the headlines of the weekend. There is so much to talk about. Blue Jays and MLB, of course, will be our focus. We'll talk about Austin Matthews. Did the Leafs handle that right? Did they mess it up? The RBC Canadian Open, the Olympics, and much more. Great you're with us here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan on this beautiful morning. You can also pick up Sportsnet 590 The Fan on HD Radio at 92.5 FM, HD Channel 3, and listen crystal clear throughout the country. You want to reach the show at any time, you can follow me on Twitter at TheRaj590 or follow Gary or Jordan and drop a tweet. Love to hear from you guys. Boys, nice to be back in the chair with you. And nice to be talking about meaningful. We don't have to worry about meaningful games in September. Can we agree? I know we'll disagree on a lot of things, but there are going to be meaningful games in September. And let's hope Marco Estrada is pitching in September like he did last night.
Well, for sure. I mean, that, you know, despite the loss, that's the one positive, seeing Marco Estrada coming off. You know, there's a guy who had multiple cortisone shots the week before the All-Star game, and he looked a little uncomfortable early last night, but he managed to settle down and keep the game under control, and they needed that because he may be a big player down the stretch here.
Well, that's the thing that he said, right, when he went out before the All-Star break, because it's kind of not a thing that's going to be totally fixed until after the season, but what he was hoping is some rest and, you know, relaxation will maybe make him feel a little looser. And he did look like he loosened up as that game went along. And, you know, that's the biggest signal. If the Jays have been, aside from Jose Bautista, remarkably lucky, I think, with the health of their major players this year. And, you know, with the rotation as great as it's been, the biggest worry for them is an injury to a starting pitcher who's been at the top of the rotation. And losing Marco Estrada for any amount of time would really hurt.
Well, and you look at the rotation as it sits with a healthy Estrada, you feel good. There's Estrada. Stroman had a good outing the other day. We know Dickey can chew it up. We know Jay Happ has had a fantastic year. And there's Sanchez. And the discussion on Sanchez as constructed. So let me ask you guys this, and I threw this out the other night, and I'm curious what you boys think. Let's say the Jays are unable to get another pitcher. Does that change their plan for Sanchez? If they do not have another starter, is it Hutch from Buffalo? Is it a fill-in? Or do they say, you know what, let's take the chance of stretching Irma?
Well, it's amazing to see how the narrative has changed just in the last month. I mean, you know, about a month ago, you know, 4 to 6 weeks ago, John Gibbons was saying it was definitely going to happen. You know, that there was no question that he was eventually going to move to the bullpen. No matter how well Aaron Sanchez was playing, they were going to watch his innings, monitor that very carefully. And now, you know, this week you're hearing Gibbons say, well, there's a lot of internal debate and, you know, it's a decision we're going to have to make soon. So it seems like there's already a little bit more give in that conversation. But he's sitting at like 125 innings now. I think his career high is like just over 130. So that decision's got to come really soon. And what the Jays can do in the trade market here in the next couple of weeks will likely determine where Aaron Sanchez is a few weeks from now.
It's amazing how quickly the dialogue changes when you get a month full of Cy Young caliber starting pitching from the guy who's become your staff ace. And that's not a knock on Estrada, who, like I said, has been great. But, you know, where I land on it is I don't see how you can do it to this team right now, who is, you know, last night aside, has been rolling for the last month, basically. And I don't see, unless Aaron Sanchez is on board with this, I don't see how you can do it to this kid who is having a season that really would legitimately put him in Cy Young contention. He probably wouldn't win it, but he'd be up there. And, you know, how are you going to do that to a guy having his first great season as a full starter and be like, well, nice run, it's over?
He's such an important asset moving forward, though. It's the long-term picture that makes that decision for you. Because, I mean, I think there's no question short-term, his best place is in that rotation. I mean, the way he's pitching this season, the position the Jays are in the standing and making a run here at the division again, you need him in your rotation. Unless you're able to get something on the market, if you're able to get a starting pitcher on the market for a reasonable price, and you strengthen both your rotation and your bullpen by doing that, it makes the most sense. But they're strictly looking long-term with a choice like that.
But guys get hurt. You know, guys get hurt pitching out of the bullpen. Guys get hurt in the starting rotation. Guys get hurt who have an innings cap and are shut down in mid-September, get hurt the following spring. And every pitcher is different. And Sanchez, you know, we wrote about it in the magazine before the season, worked with Stroman all offseason to build himself up, to put extra muscle on, to get himself in shape, to be a starting pitcher that would hold up for the entire season. And unless there's something going on, some dialogue going on between Sanchez and Gibby or whatever, I don't see how you cannot at least give him that chance until he starts wearing down.
You know, the funny thing about the argument, maybe funny's not the right word, guys, but, you know, I agree with the way you presented it. But here's the thing is, like, you don't think the Blue Jays want to win this year? Like, the way fans are looking at this, how can they do this? Because they have... You don't think the front office is aware that, hey, this guy's been a great starter for us? Clearly, they've got data. And I'm not saying I agree with it. But clearly, their information is we better not do this. It's the best chance. And it's almost like an insurance policy, guys. Do you get insurance or you don't? Well, then something happens. Oh, my God. Thank God we had insurance. You don't get insurance. Oh, well, see, you didn't need it. So that's the hard thing for me, because if I could, somebody could demonstrate to me clearly, and I'm sure the Blue Jays are probably going through this, not probably, they're going through it. They sit around, they go, what really is the probability? And is there that much of a difference in 150 innings opposed to 170 inches? In the same way, I look at an in-game thing. Why does every major league pitcher have to come out after around 100 pitches? Every single one, you can't go 114. They took a strat out once in the sixth inning. Gibby got the question afterwards. But they go, it's 100 pitches, and you better not go, really. But obviously, it does. So that's the thing. I'm sure the Jays are just as anxious as a fan base to win this year. The best way is to let Sanchez start. Yet they don't want to start him. They must have some numbers.
I think they know that. And I mean, I think the problem is, and we've seen it with pitchers that kind of go over that innings cap or, you know, kind of push beyond their limits, it's always the following season. And, you know, we talk about how important Aaron Sanchez is to this team moving forward and being that young piece in that rotation. I think that's where their concern comes. And Gibbons even pointed to some of the Mets players. He used that as an example. He's like, you're seeing it with the Mets now. Like, it's always the kind of long-term impact that it has on a pitcher by going over that innings cap. And that's clearly what they're watching with Sanchez.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the other aspect of it that we haven't really talked about is the competitive advantage you do gain in the bullpen by putting him there. That bullpen has been shaky beyond Asuna all year. Guys have had stretches. Storen's had stretches where he looked better, stretches where he looked horrible. Same can be true for Biagini. All these guys, none of them has really taken that job and run with it. And, you know, they probably, as a part of this, they look back to their bullpen of last fall and see Sanchez setting it up for Asuna and being able to lock down the last couple of innings. And, he's probably more valued to you as a starter, but there's certainly a lot of value in being able to put him back in that role.
The one problem I have with that is I feel like if the Jays are actually in the trade market, you know, they don't have a lot of assets to give up, as we've seen, they've given up so many over the last couple of years. Wouldn't it be easier for them to land a middle relief guy on the trade market or like a setup guy as opposed to going out and getting a starter that's going to give you what Aaron Sanchez has given you in the rotation?
Well, they tried to land a setup guy on the free agent market and it didn't work. And the problem with trading for relief pitching, especially like unless we're talking about going to the Yankees and getting Aroldis Chapman or one of those guys that they're giving up. The problem with that is you never know how a new pitcher is going to fit into your bullpen unless he's a legitimate elite talent and those guys aren't available very much. So it's kind of a crapshoot. And, you know what Sanchez is going to do because you've seen it. You've seen him in this situation with these players. And I think that's something that they are thinking about hard.
I don't really think, guys, that there's any way they could, on the trade market, find somebody who could give them what Sanchez did last year at the back of the bullpen. And I think a deciding factor in it, and I can't speak for them, I don't know, but I think a deciding factor is compared to other pitchers, you know, massage it or shut him down in September or skip a start or whatever. But here's the thing. They know he can pitch relief. They know he does it well. They know he has the mentality, as opposed to, let's say it was, you know, Stroman pitching. Oh, well, we're going to put him in the bullpen where there's a big question mark. Well, has he got the mentality? Can come in and do it. We know Sanchez can close people out. To me, that's the tipper. That's the tipper is like, and you mentioned it, Jordan, you're absolutely right. Look at that bullpen now with him back there. And that's what they're thinking. And how often we'll see when they actually do make the move. Mid-August, early September in the playoffs, how often do you see a fifth starter anyway? Somebody's sitting down. And I'll tell you what, if Sanchez is in the rotation, you know who's not pitching? R.A. Dickey. Think about it. Who's the fifth starter?
You can't sit any of those other guys, not the way they're pitching
now.
Unless Jay Happer or Marco Estrada falls off a cliff.
Injury.
And that's possible, and it's good to have that kind of insurance. But that's the thing. When you talk about now bringing Drew Hutchison up from Buffalo to take Sanchez's spot, he wouldn't be up for that many starts because as you get in there late, you start skipping starts, you start trying to manipulate your rotation, especially in the playoffs. And I think even just slotting Sanchez into that bullpen, which again, I think you can't do it unless Sanchez is buying in, but slotting him into that bullpen makes the other pitchers in that bullpen better. Like Brett Cecil looks a lot better as a guy who's being asked to pitch in situational role in the seventh inning. And, you know, Biagini looks a lot better as like your, oh, my starter has to come out early. Let's just fill the gap here. Everything kind of falls into place a little bit better with him back there.
R.A. Dickey is going to be this year's Mark Burley in the playoffs if Sanchez is still in the rotation. I'm convinced of that. And that's incredulous when you think about it. And I said that on the other air, and then people go, oh, come on. You don't like Dickey. I like Dickey very much. He's an innings eater. He's a veteran. But think about it. If you're so what? You're going to pitch Dickey ahead of Sanchez, Estrada, Hap? Seriously? I don't think there's and then you look at it, it's like where is you can't put Dickey in the bullpen with the knuckler. You can't have him come in with like the bases loaded. What, bring in Toley to replace
Josh
Martin
Toley
at the same
comes
time?
In too.
I don't think so. So in other words, that's the significance here. I still say the back of the bullpen, because he's had success there, makes me okay with it. And you're right. If he's gotta be cool with it. But at the end of the day, you're trying to, aren't you on the same page? The Blue Jays and Sanchez should be on the same page. Sanchez wants to blow his arm out for one run and ruin his career too. Usually it's funny with other teams, guys, we've seen it. It's the pitcher or the agent of the pitcher sometimes who's saying, hey, watch it, blah, blah. And if the team's not in the race, who cares?
And if Sanchez wasn't having this kind of season,
true,
right? Like this is like asking a guy who's already to 30 home runs in July to sit down and, you know, start batting every second day. Like this is he's got a chance to rack up stats that will make him millions and millions of dollars.
If you're the Blue Jays, you welcome this problem with Sanchez. This is a discussion you're glad you're having, because if he was, you know, if he was 1-10 and then there's no conversation, there's no debate, you're moving him to the bullpen. But he's been so good, and that's the reason why it's such a struggle to make this decision.
And if the Blue Jays were 8 games out, it'd be a moot point too. There's no doubt about that. Gary Mello, Jordan Heath, Rawlings with me, Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie. Great to be with you here on this beautiful morning here in Toronto. So Jose Bautista gets his rehab start. Doesn't matter what he does at the bat. We know what he can do, but it does lead a dilemma because the timing of injuries, guys, are always difficult. But here's where the Blue Jays are at. Colabello is coming back and he's getting some at-bats. Bautista will be back in right field, so you can be relatively confident you get something out of them. So if you can't do pitching and you don't get that start, everyone agrees, if you get another starter, go for it. Is there a solution? Is it a veteran bat? Does it have to be the young, controllable player? There's lots of rumors up there. Upton's out there now. People were talking about Carlos Beltran, for heaven's sakes, as a rental to come in as a bat. The only problem is then I think he gets 3 DHs with Beltran. I love Carlos Beltran in the postseason especially, but Beltran's a DH. The way Bautista plays right field, he's a DH. Edwin's a DH. Who's going to play first? What do you guys think in terms of if it's not a pitcher, what would you like to see them do?
Well, I think the Upton one is the most interesting one to me, because that's a position I didn't think the Blue Jays would be chasing on the market, but that might speak more to what they're planning to do with Jose Bautista here in the long run. I mean, Bautista, you know, as you mentioned, he had his start in Buffalo yesterday. You know, tonight he's going to be DHing in Buffalo, so I wonder if that's a role maybe that he finds himself more in going down the stretch. Another interesting one that comes up for me this week is the catcher situation. You know, Russell Martin has a slip in the sauna or after some time in the sauna, and all of a sudden the catcher situation looks really bleak for the Blue Jays, because we all know who the backup catcher is in Toronto. You have him going out every couple of nights. Like if this Russell Martin injury is more than a couple of days, then that's a situation the Jays are going to have to address by the end of the month.
Josh Toley is not even a backup catcher at this point in his career. And I say that, you know, no offense to Josh Toley, who does his job, who does what's asked of him as well as he can, because it's tough to catch that knuckleballer. But, you know, the quality of backup catchers in MLB right now is above what Josh Toley is giving the Blue Jays. I mean, you look at what they had last year in Deonor Navarro, who was the quintessential platoon catcher and, you know, did his job, had no problems spotting, starting every couple games or whatever. They need to be aware that that could be a problem down the stretch. And if this Martin injury doesn't make them take that seriously, I'd be surprised.
That is a big hole. You're right about that one, Jordan. And that's a tough one to fill. That might even be tougher than finding the pitcher. Which team in Major League Baseball has got a really good backup catcher that they're willing to let go? In fact, it shows you of all the things that happened in the offseason, this team really missed Navarro.
There are some NL catchers out there. There are a bunch of NL teams who have two catchers that they're kind of running out there and are looking to trade one. There's Norris in San Diego. There's a few people out there. But you know, if you're the Blue Jays and you already kind of have limited chips to push in at the trade deadline because of all the prospects you dealt last year, and you start looking at, well, we could use a backup catcher. You know, we definitely need one more starter. We definitely use another outfielder. But, you know, how do you prioritize that? Because you can't make, you're not in a position like they were last year where you can make four or five trades. You have to pick your spots, get a couple of players. So it becomes a you know, which hole do you plug?
With the Jays and the catcher situation, it might come something that you look at someone who was with the franchise before, and Eric Kratz, who was just recently let go by the Pirates. Like, he's probably a player you can go without having you get, you know, go after without giving up any assets. Other than that, you've got Carlos Ruiz with Philly. You know, you mentioned a couple. So it's a really tough position to fill because there's not a lot
And even those guys, you're right. Good to mention the names, but honestly, the drop off from Martin there is substantial. It's better than Toley,
though. But the upgrade, though,
yeah, it's an upgrade over Toley. No argument there. But that is a tough one to fill. I love the way the team is positioned. I don't think there's any question it's going to be an entertaining end of the season. And later on, we'll talk about what the Red Sox and the Orioles may do. But I'm just curious in terms of the big boomer, because last year's trade deadline, I'll never forget the night Tulowitzki was out. Because, you know, we've hearing all these rumors. The night that deal was made, guys, and I don't know, you know, what your perception was. My producer buzzes in at me. He's flipping out behind the glass. The Blue Jays just got Tulowitzki. And I went, first of all, he's available? Like, Troy Tulowitzki is coming to the Blue Jays? What are they going to do with Reyes? And then, of course, we later find out how the deal is. It went right off. They need pitching, they need pitching, they need pitching, and they just add another bat.
Some people were really upset with that, too. Yeah, there was a lot of fans who were really upset because they thought that was it. That was the acquisition.
Exactly, and they weren't going to get a pitcher, and they were just going to exchange shortstops, and maybe they didn't watch Colorado because the games were too late and knew how good Tulo was. But you're right, there were people upset. So, back to it again, even if it's if it's the one deal and they can't get the pitcher and whatever they do with Sanchez, is there that maybe home run guy you can take even if you don't? Now, Tulo was still under contract. Keep him for a while. Is there somebody else? I mentioned Beltran. We mentioned Upton. I'm just still looking. You know, do they have the capability? Do they have the guts to make another blockbuster? Is there somebody out there?
If there's people out there, and we took a look at this week on sportsnet.ca, we had Jeff Simmons go through, you know, starters available, relievers available, et cetera. And the one guy to me who people wonder if he's available, but I think it's pretty clear that he could be pried away, is Sonny Gray in Oakland. And now that is, he's having he's struggling this year. You know, he hasn't had the seasons he's had for the last couple years, but he's a young, elite starter, still got some controllable years left. And, I mean, if you can add a piece like that to the rotation, I think that's something that's worth giving up some prospects for.
I think there's two differences this year. One, obviously the assets. They're not there like they have been in the past. It's not quite as bad as everyone makes it seem. They have a couple of young players, too, that have come through the system this year that are having good seasons, and they've upped their stock a little bit. But they're obviously, there's not as many pieces there to make that big splash, I don't think. The second thing is, that was Alex Anthopoulos' style. He's not the man running the team anymore. I'm not sure Mark Shapiro.
They're not that secretive?
Yeah.
They don't have a secret room that nobody taps their phones or checks their emails? Like, that was brilliant dealing. That was absolutely brilliant. And Josh Donaldson, like, he did some stuff, and he did some other stuff that wasn't so great. But my goodness, he
Alex
did some
had
work
an act
that
for
way.
That. Yeah. You know, he had an act for that. I'm not sure that's Shapiro's MO. We'll see how it goes. I mean, you look at his track record in Cleveland, and that wasn't necessarily the case, but who knows? I mean, he's obviously in a position now with the Blue Jays where they're in a spot to contend. If they make a big splash, it could push him over. So it'll be interesting to see how these next few weeks play out.
Let me throw this out. What about if Carrera becomes more of a full-time outfielder? You move to Bautista to DH and Edwin plays first base.
Oh, gosh. That does not excite me yet. No, I think a whole bunch of your listeners just driving around the car just groaned at the thought of Zeke Carrera being an everyday outfielder. No offense to him. He's done a great job. Much like Josh Toley. Guy who does a great job at what he's asked to do, but when you ask him to do more, it becomes very clear that he's not at the level that you're trying to play
him
at. Okay,
but Bautista with the bad toe and already starting to slip defensively in right field.
Oh, bring up Dalton Pompey if you really need a right fielder. Pompey was amazing in the playoffs last year, not because he was there every day or whatever, but to have that element of speed off the bench for pinch running, all that kind of stuff. You know, he has, and the upside, I think everybody around this table would agree, is a lot higher than Ezekiel Carrera. That's not to say that he'll come up and have figured things out. But, you know, I think a guy like that, who until he had his concussion, and even since he's come back, has been hitting the cover off the ball down there. And why wouldn't you, if you're the Blue Jays, look internally, especially if the cost for, say, an Upton is going to be high?
I'm not sure Bautista is going to be able to play outfield. That's my only concern. I just already, you see the slippage.
Oh, I agree.
And then Edwin goes into first, but the left side of the infield's defense, it's the challenge when it comes down to. Are we confident enough in this team as, let's just say, the deadline comes? I hope it doesn't, but the deadline comes status quo roughly. All right? We'll get to the Red Sox Orioles later, but let's say nothing else really transpires. As we're sitting today, Orioles are up by a half on the Red Sox, Jays are two back. Are the Blue Jays still the best team in the American League East? And if you're sitting there, all things being equal, without injuries, do you think they win the division?
All things being equal today, I think they have a great shot. But I think the problem is I don't anticipate the Red Sox and Orioles standing pat as well. I think if they make moves to improve their roster, and the interesting thing is all three teams really need pitching help. So, you know, it's not only are they all in the race, but they're all looking for the same thing. And another team who has a bunch of those pieces that the three teams could use is also in the division, the New York Yankees. And no one knows if they're going to be buyers or sellers at this point. So status quo, I think they do have a good shot to win out the division or at least get into the wild card. But if the Red Sox and the Orioles make moves, and we saw Ken Rosenthal this morning talking about how the Orioles are also going hard after Cashner, who's been rumored, the Jays have been watching, then that changes the situation.
First of all, I think that would be excellent because Andrew Cashner would get destroyed in the AL East in some of these smaller parks. But at the same time, if we're talking about the other team standing pat as well, then I think you give the edge to the Jays just because their rotation is clearly better than the Red Sox and the Orioles, at least the way it's constructed right now. And, you know, you're looking down the stretch, big September games. I will tend to give the edge to the team with the better rotation, especially when it's as good on offense as the Jays are. But I think they need to do something, not necessarily a huge thing, but just to show that they're committed, to show the players. I think I'm not talking about appeasing the fans, because the fans are always going to do what they're going to do. Some of them will like it, some of them will question it. But I think you saw in the Jays clubhouse last year when they brought in those pieces, the players themselves were more energized. They got really excited. They started feeling a change in the vibe, like we're really getting after it. And I think even if it's just a move that brings in somebody who's good in the clubhouse, who they can rely on, I think that sends a message to the players like, oh, we see you and we're helping you and we're trying to give you whatever we can to make this happen.
That's an excellent point, because all further to what you said in terms of the attitude, the PR department was standing up taller when David Price came to town. I was in the ballpark that night the first time, and he's sitting there with a Blue Jay jersey and a hat. In his introductory little chat, remember, he made the drive, he got stuck on the highway and came in late and all the kerfuffle. Everybody all of a sudden just stood up like this.
But
so people can say what they want in terms of the stats, the numbers, the Excel spreadsheet. What Jordan is talking about, it's more than just an Excel spreadsheet. And let's go back 2 years ago. You guys remember? Jose Bautista, not even cryptically. I was going to say cryptically.
Yeah, no, he wasn't being subtle.
He was being subtle. Okay, well, I guess we're not going to do anything again. And the team goes off, and we have no meaningful games in September. So there is that. And you're right, you just can't make a move for the sake of making a move. But if you do nothing, there is the kind of thing, the guy's sitting around. And I know the flip side. Well, we have confidence in you, so we know you can do it. I think the players want to see something happen.
But you also have to keep in mind, too. I mean, Tulowitzki and Price will do that for everyone's confidence. I'm not sure Cashner will. Like, I don't know if it has that much of an impact on a team that already feels it's a pretty strong ball club. You're not going to add two pieces that significant in order to kind of boost the confidence that much, I don't think.
No, but you're gonna send a message that we're aware, we see where there's holes in this lineup, or we see where there's things that could be fixed, and we're on it. And, you know, yeah, is that going to make all the players feel super proud because they've got this, you know, say you got another bullpen arm, you know?
Yeah.
That's great, but it does something to a team to be a player. You know, you feel like you're in the game because for the next week, I promise you, the Blue Jays and every other team will be hearing about, oh, the Red Sox just pushed their chips in and got this guy. And, oh, the Orioles are out hunting for this guy and they've got a budget and they've got prospects to spend. And it sucks feeling like your team is totally left out of that. So that's why I think they'll do something, even if it is just a minor move.
I agree with that. And it's not a case of just dealing for the sake of dealing. But I agree with that psychology. But we'll see. We should give a tip of the hat to the baseball fans in Toronto, because one thing the trade deadline did last year, and I just, you know, I'm one of the official scorers of the Jays. I do 30-odd games a year, and I'm sitting up there, and I like to look at the attendance figures, and I've been on air here forever, and I look at them, and last year the Blue Jays are in the middle of the pack. But from the moment the deal was made, the moment of Price and Tulo, the ticket sales went through the roof. We're almost a calendar year now. The Blue Jays are now number one in the American League in attendance, fourth or fifth in the majors behind some of the big established National League teams. That certainly gives you a degree of flexibility and confidence that whatever resources that they want are going to be there for them. I'd say they're going to spend the payroll, and they don't have to, nor should they. By the way, a little trivia, Seattle Mariners have a higher payroll than the Toronto Blue Jays. So how's that working out? So, but basically, I think the fans supporting it the way they have, my goodness, that bodes well for the future. If you can sell that park out another year, that's a game changer.
It certainly helps you maintain the payroll at 140 or more if you can. I think the problem with the Blue Jays is where they're spending it, and they have to spend it wisely. You look at how many players are already locked up for next season and moving through with, I think they have like seven players at like $87 million or something like that. So that's pretty tough. That's a big part. Even if you are at $140 million, you're able to maintain that payroll. That's a big chunk of your salary that's already tied up.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at what the Blue Jays have done, it's impressive, and you want to know why the fans come. The fans come because they're scoring six runs a game. You know, it's
fun
nice
to watch.
Yeah, it's nice to get Tulo. It's nice to have Price for a little while, and everybody wants to come to the ballpark. But at the same time, homers sell tickets, you know, knowing that you're going to go to a game and see, you know, something happen. How many of us remember going to Blue Jays games in the early 2000s and you would go because Roy Halladay was pitching, and then you would go and hope to see like a 2-0 win, right? Which if you're a big baseball fan, watching an ace pitch is always terrific. But there was not a lot beyond Halladay and Delgado. There was not a lot to make you excited about coming to the ballpark, regardless of where they were in the standings. Whereas now, even if you go and you see the Blue Jays lose, you're going to see some big names taking big cuts, and you're going to feel like you're getting value for your money.
Bautista and Edwin, the elephant in the room, before we move on and talk about the Yankees in a few minutes, boys, ultimately, would you sign either or both of those guys? And again, the price, we know free agents are crazy. I'll start off. I would re-sign Edwin, unless it's totally ridiculous, but I would re-sign him. He's 33. I'm invested in him. Bautista, it's a good thing I wasn't in charge of the club, because I might have re-signed him at the start of the year. But now, especially given the expected bidding war, no. Would I sign one guy just for the sake, again, the psychology? And this is where the psychology, you know, what you were just talking about in terms of psychology, like on the Excel spreadsheet, I'm sure, I'll use an example, David Ortiz. When David Ortiz signed his final year with the Red Sox, I'm sure they, mind you, he's blowing the doors out in his final year, but I'm sure they looked at it. Oh, come on, 40 years old. You can't give him that much, but he's your guy. He's your guy. So of all we've talked about with the excitement, I don't want to say are they incumbent to sign one or the other, but they're certainly incumbent to try. No, Gary?
I think so. I mean, it's funny because you mentioned the beginning of the season. I was the same mind where, start of the season, I was ready to sign Jose Bautista and let Edwin walk. And here we are in July, and I'm kind of feeling the other way around. You know, if Batista's going to cost as much as he, you know, everyone thinks he's going to cost, you know, Edwin seems like a pretty good fit. And maybe I shouldn't think this way, but just knowing that the Red Sox and all the talk out there about getting Edwin and stuff, I figure by keeping Edwin, you're also keeping him away from a division rival. That's not to say that they couldn't scoop up Jose Bautista or someone else in the division, but I just feel like Edwin's proved that, you know, that he's a very important bat in the lineup. The Jays have been playing pretty well without Bautista. We've talked about how his defense, and it's not exactly getting any better in right field. So I feel like perhaps Edwin, who is going to cost a lot less than Jose, is probably the better fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think Edwin's the guy you want to re-sign as it stands now. I wouldn't have signed either of them before the season just because I don't like caving to demands of older players who still have time left on their contract. And I realize that'll get you into trouble sometimes, and you'll end up paying the price for it later when they go off and get $30 million a year from the Boston Red Sox and you're left holding the bag. But if the Blue Jays are going to be a contending team going forward, and it sure looks like, regardless of Edwin and Jose, that they have the pieces to do that. Josh Donaldson isn't going anywhere. The arms are around. You do have to send a statement. It's just a question of whether what the market will be like. Is sending a statement and that psychological message we talked about worth $120 million for 4 years of Edwin Encarnacion until he's 37? Like, I just don't know. And
it's
there are other players out there. You know, there will be bats that you can get. Look at what Michael Saunders has done this year, right? If you can go out and find players like that, I realize it's a lot harder than it sounds to say on the air, but, you know, that's a better way to spend your money. And if you can re-sign Saunders for 4 years and $40 million this year, you know, is that a better use of your money? It probably is, right?
Yeah, probably is. And then Edwin is happy junior with the Red Sox, and Bautista's doing bad flips for the Yankees. That'll help the crowds for those games.
Well, but everybody will be sad for 3 months until they come back and start winning, right?
And
everybody
Bautista
was sad about David Price. This was the exact same conversation we had last fall about David Price, and I agree. It would have been, you know, nice for the fans to sign him. It would have sent a message that Toronto was a real player, and now you'd be holding the bag without Marco Estrada, without Jay Happ, and with David Price and his 4.39 ERA.
I think Edwin leaves a bigger hole, though, to be fair, though. I think David Price is going out. He's pitching once every 5 days. I'm sure he's a fantastic pitcher, and you can't you can't undervalue that. But I think Edwin leaves a bigger hole in that lineup. I don't think you can just plug a Saunders in there. As good a season as Saunders has had, I think the Blue Jays are not as good a team with that big hole.
And no, there's no question. Yeah. But then you have $80 million more to go and spend on other things. This is all assuming that the payroll doesn't drop, nor should it, with the crowd packing the house every night. But it's a matter of, like you were talking about before, right? Managing your money. You already have Tulo, who's going to be making $20 million for the next 3-4 years. You know, you have to find ways to save someplace so that you can pay the rest of it.
It is interesting. It's always a decision for the ownership. End of the day, though, David Price was a Blue Jay for, 2 months? And Bautista and Edwin have been Blue Jays for a long time. There is that factor as well. But they are a fascinating team. New York Yankees are fascinating. What are they going to do? Are they actually going to dump payroll? Maybe. And if they do, would they trade in the division? We'll talk about that next. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis. Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello along at Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Evan Rosser.
This time they do get away. Now it's Donovan Bailey trying to pick up runners. Donovan Bailey is putting on a third. Adam Molden in the lead. Here comes Bailey. He's got it. 9-8-4, a world record for Donovan Bailey and a gold medal.
Chances are you remember where you were when Donovan Bailey ran his 9-8-4 to take home 100-meter gold at the Atlanta Games in 96. Chances are, if you close your eyes for a minute, you can still conjure the image of Bailey fresh across the line, eyes wide, screaming with joy. There's a reason that's still floating around in your brain. The 100-meter dash is the premier event at the Olympic Games. Prestigious enough to etch the winner's name into history, simple enough for a 3-year-old to understand. The fastest man on earth is Canadian. That one thought brought a rush of pride we can still remember 2 decades later. And at the Rio Games in August, we may get to feel it again.
It is the most amazing talent I've witnessed in my 40-odd years in track and field. I just haven't come across anything like it.
This guy's a once-in-a-generation talent, no doubt.
He could be Olympic champion.
Headlining our Olympic package, read the story of how Markham, Ontario's Andre DeGrasse went from a 17-year-old who'd never run a competitive race to Canada's best shot at 100-meter gold since Donovan Bailey. All in just 4 years.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Serving up stats, scores, and more. Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand, absolutely free.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis this week. Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello alongside as we continue to talk about Major League Baseball. Trade deadline is creeping up. It's August 1st this year. Too much to expect that the Blue Jays could hit those proverbial home runs they did last year, boys, with the great week Alex Anthopoulos did. But maybe the bigger story in focus now is on the New York Yankees, who still, according to the latest stats, have the second highest payroll in Major League Baseball at $214 million. They are 4 or 5 games out of a wild card. I guess technically you're still alive, but you look at the age of Beltran and A-Rod and Teixeira with his injuries and even Ellsbury, and you think, my goodness, there was ever a team that was going to unload. It's the New York Yankees. But can the New York Yankees bear to unload?
I don't think so. I think the Yankees are one of those teams that until they are dead and buried, they will not give up. And, you know, they basically were a couple of innings away from sweeping the Orioles. And, you know, they certainly showed that they can play with them. And you have to think that the way that organization is set up, that they're not looking at this and saying, well, it's time to pack it in, guys. Like, you going to trade Andrew Miller? Andrew Miller is probably their best trade chip right now. But he's a guy that if you have designs on being in the playoffs in 2 or 3 years, he's a guy you want on that team. So,
Well, I mean, they're 4.5 back in the wild card race now, so that's a pretty, that's not a very big number. We saw what the Blue Jays were able to do late last year. Mind you, I don't imagine the Yankees are going to be that big of sellers at this deadline, just because from an asset standpoint, they've also got an eye to the future as well. But this weekend might go a long way in determining whether or not they're buyers and sellers by the end of the month, because, you know, they got the Giants in town, and although they're struggling, they've lost six straight now. You know, the Giants are a pretty good team, and they, you know, the Yankees are facing Samardzija and Cueto this weekend, so... You know, how they play out there might determine which direction they go in by the end of the month.
Chapman and Miller are obviously the pieces of the back of the bullpen everybody's talked about. They do have some starting pitchers that maybe a change of scenery would help them. They do have pieces to move. If you're the Blue Jays, I don't know if the Yankees and the Blue Jays will ever deal or if the Yankees would trade in the division. But if they did, obviously the back end of the bullpen solves your problem and let Sanchez finish the season as a starter. But who, anybody you'd target, do you like on that team?
Well, if you can get either of those guys, I mean, I think you should. The question is that in order to get those guys, you're going to have to give up pretty elite prospect or more than one. And if you're the Blue Jays, first of all, you probably don't like dealing with the Yankees anyway, nor do they like dealing with the Jays. But if you do make that deal and then you see a guy who you gave up for a rental come back to haunt you in your division every year for the next 5 or 10 years, that'll leave a mark.
Yeah. And Cashman just came out recently and said, you know, we are not going to be sellers. Like, we may be buyers. Now, that can mean one of two things: that A, genuinely, they think they're in this and they can get into the playoffs either through a wild card spot or contending in the division. Or two, he's just trying to up the value for those trade assets he does have. So if you want to come for a Miller or a Chapman, you better pay for it.
Well, you'd have to. There's no point in dealing if that's the case, because I know, you know, fans and everyone else likes teams to unload. While you're out of the playoff race, unload. It's like, well, wait a second. Why? Like, just because we're not going to win this year, everyone talks about, well, don't have the all chip in mentality if you're a contender. But if you're a team that's having a crappy year, you just don't then throw out the baby with the bathwater. Like, for heaven's sakes, like, if you think, unless, like you say, somebody really comes to the punch. And that's where the Yankees are still a tweener team in terms of still close enough to think they have a chance. And they're the Yankees.
But
they don't do that.
That's the difference, right? Between the Yankees or the Tampa Bay Rays or the Oakland A's or whomever, the Yankees, regardless of whether they're buyers or sellers in the next week, the Yankees are expecting to win the division next year, right? It's not like the Yankees are going to unload these pieces because,
for double A prospects.
Because, we think we're entering a down period and it's going to take us 2 to 3 years for our prospects to grow, and we're willing to wait that out and build a team that's all young and cohesive. That's not how the Yankees operate. If the Yankees are trading pieces now, they're still expecting to reload and re-up these guys come free agent time and be back in the hunt next year. So that's why you don't trade Andrew Miller. You might trade Chapman because he's an expiring contract.
Well, and the Yankees are one of those teams where, you know, other teams would be, let's get rid of an expiring contract just to get something for him. But what the Yankees will do is they'll just sign him anyways. They'll just throw the money at him anyways and keep him around even if he is an expiring contract at the end of the year.
But maybe what the Yankees can do then, and maybe they're thinking of this too, is you trade Chapman for a prospect now, and then you go and re-sign Chapman.
Yeah, you could. As a free agent, you always have that ability. Just to give a perspective on what we're talking about in terms of payrolls, I was looking at this during the break. Los Angeles Dodgers have the highest payroll in baseball, $259 million. They have $83 million on the disabled list. The Tampa Bay Rays entire payroll is $72 million. The Los Angeles Dodgers have more money on the disabled list than the Tampa Bay Rays are paying for their 25-man roster. You think about the discrepancies in salaries in baseball and how this league even works. And we've seen Tampa Bay's won a division. They won the World Series. It's like somehow, some way, baseball works where other leagues need a salary cap where there's a bridge. It's at the moment, Dodgers at just shy of 260, Tampa Bay at 72, and they play in the same league. Guys, I'm telling you, I just can't get it. Boston Red Sox, by the way, have $22 million buried and $47 million on the disabled list and are still going to spend. Who do they target? Like, they've got Pomeranz. Do they can't deal with the Yankees, can they?
No.
Although that would be fun.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
It'd be great for this.
Yeah.
It'd be like Johnny Damon, except forced, you know? Like, I mean, like making a deal with it. Do they have any options? Because that's the teams we're talking about, the Jays, Orioles and Red Sox. If they make the move quicker, and from what I hear, Red Sox have more to offer, much more to offer right now in their system than the Jays do, at least in top end.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just because they didn't trade many of their top end prospects last year,
and
those prospects are a year ahead of the Jays of the next Jays on the development scale. But do the Red Sox still need to make moves? Absolutely. I mean, I look at that, you know, they've made a couple of acquisitions. Ziegler is not a bad acquisition for the back of the bullpen, but you know, that's still a team that struggles, in my opinion anyway, with their rotation. I'm not scared. If I'm an opposing team going into a 7-game playoff series with the Boston Red Sox, I'm not especially frightened of those guys.
And Drew Pomeranz is not it. They're not
He's
done
not
with
answer.
That acquisition. And his debut didn't exactly go all that well the other night. So I imagine the Red Sox are not done dealing. And they got a lot of young pieces that a lot of, I think, teams around the league would love to get their hands on. So I expect a deal or two from the Red Sox.
They need a front of the rotation starter, essentially. And it's sad to say it. They need what they thought they were signing in David Price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need another David Price or another pitcher that pitched like David Price did for the Blue Jays last year. You're right. We got about a minute. Carlos Beltran, great postseason hitter, last rental. Does he finish in New York? Or like, if there's a guy, if they find the Yankees, that's not going to ruin your bid for the thing next year. He's still got a lot of pop, but he's 39 years old.
Yeah, how much are you getting for Carlos Beltran, though?
Probably not much. That's my point. Probably not much. So if it's not much, man, he's one of the best postseason hitters in Major League history on a playoff team this year. I just look at him. You add him to any lineup in the middle of a lineup. Holy smokes.
Wow. Well, if you platoon him and Jose Bautista in right field, you'd have the anti-gold glove.
That would be worth the price of admission watching those two guys go down. Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis. Delighted to be with Jordan Heath Rawlings and Gary Mello. Coming up, well, the Toronto Maple Leafs always managed to make some off-season news, and they did with Austin Matthews and the way the contract negotiations reportedly went down. But at the end of the day, it was a standard number one overall signing. How do we feel about the Maple Leafs as they get into the really second full year of this complete rebuild? And the RBC Canadian Open back in the day was considered the fifth major. It was one of the biggest events in Canada. It's on this weekend. Is it still? Well, it's not a fifth major, but are they making inroads? And, of course, the Rogers Cup coming up as well. Milos passing on the Olympics, but is he the favorite at the Rogers Cup? We'll talk about all that coming up next on Sportsnet Magazine. Roger Lajoie, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Gary Mello right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
I'm not content to be with you in the daytime.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis this week. Jordan Heath Rawlings and Gary Mello alongside. In this hour, we'll talk about the Canadian Open, the Olympics, the doping scandal. And of course, on the hottest, could be the hottest day of the summer today here in Toronto. Very hot weekend. What else are we going to talk about with the Toronto Maple Leafs? Because they did do some paperwork business. It's supposed to be pretty standard. You draft the number one overall pick in the NHL, that should be the easiest contract negotiation you're ever going to see, guys. Yet, according to reports, it was one of the Toronto Star the night before the deal was signed. Maybe it wasn't as standard as acrimony, and there were a little acrimony between the sides. I can't conceive how that's possible. But, Gary, when we look at it, was there any reason to be concerned about that? Now that he's inked, everything's okay. But how could you do, like, the first overall pick, it's standard. The absolute max you can give him under the CBA, and give them a pile of bonuses. Get over it.
Well, it is Toronto. We do need something to talk about at the Leafs in the middle of July, so why the heck not, right? Well, I think the problem is, you know, it's Lou's rules. It's Lou Lamoriello and how he approaches things. And I think that's why everyone was starting to sweat a little bit. You know, he's got a track record of it. I think Larson was drafted by the Devils, didn't get his max, you know, bonuses in his contract. So I think that's the concern. But if you're Austin Matthews' camp, you know, you tell the Leafs before the draft, you know, there is no negotiation. Austin Matthews is Austin Matthews. He's the first overall pick, and he's getting his full contract. And from everything we've heard, there were no negotiations. It just took him long to get to the table and put that contract on the table for him to sign.
Yeah, and I mean, there'll be some talk because this is Toronto, and there will always be some talk. There'll be some talk about, did the Leafs alienate their future franchise player? Does this set a bad tone going forwards, you know? And none of that matters. The guy got his money. If he performs, he's going to get his incentives and the bonuses are going to come off the cap the next year and everybody's going to forget about it. I will say that it is kind of funny that of all the players to choose to play this game with, they chose the one guy who's already shown that he has no problem going to play hockey in Europe when the opportunity is there. And, you know, I just don't know why they wouldn't have just signed it right after the draft. They can't have thought that if they just waited a while or asked nicely or kept asking that Austin Matthews' camp would somehow acquiesce to a lesser deal. Like, there's zero precedent for that with the number one pick. So, you know, maybe they were just waiting till everybody was in town and back from the cottage to get it done.
Maybe. And let's hope that's the case. It's the same contract Connor McDavid got, and it should be the same contract Connor McDavid got, because he's a number one overall pick. And if they can get the value, well, that's asking a lot. But if they can get the kind of season or even the kind of start to career that McDavid and other number one overall picks have done, they'll be happy. Guys, I see no issues at all with the whole concept of bonuses in a contract. In fact, I wish there were more bonuses in a contract. I know Lou, in particular with the Devils, you mentioned Larson, a few other players, he doesn't seem to like doing business that way. I just cannot fathom how any general manager doesn't like bonuses. I know sometimes it makes you a selfish player.
This is how we know that we are on the radio in Toronto talking hockey, because we just compared Austin Matthews to Connor McDavid. It didn't even take two sentences.
Well, he's a first overall pick.
Yeah, and that's about where the comparison stops. No offense to Austin Matthews, who could be a great NHL player. Connor McDavid is in a different class.
And Patrick Kane.
Yeah. No.
Let me get some other first round back. I'm trying to take somebody else.
I think Jack Eichel is a good comparison. I mean, they're both similar bodies, similar games, both Americans, you know, and that's kind of where it starts. Connor McDavid to me is another level. But do I think that performance incentives should be a huge part of contracts? You're talking to an NFL guy in which there are no guaranteed contracts, and a lot of the money comes from hitting various incentives in your contract. And I don't honestly, if you're a professional athlete, I think you're motivated anyway, and I think that the one danger in putting those performance bonuses in is if you do it to everybody, if everybody had these bonuses, then you're pitting teammates against each other, because there's only so many goals to be scored for an NHL team. And if everybody has a bonus, if I get to 25 goals, I get $1 million, you know. How many
I'm going to pass the puck less.
You are. Well, it's human nature. I know that, like, if I got paid based on how many words I wrote compared to, you know, another person in the office getting the same amount of money for the words they wrote, we'd be fighting over stories.
Flip side, you wind up with players who have $10 million contracts with no incentive to improve. And although in a perfect world, we all like to sit back and say, yeah, you know, they're professionals and whatever. If I'm a guy who's running a team, I would like, of my 20 guys in the dressing room, 5 guys on the option years of their contract, and I'll win a championship. That's how strongly
that doesn't matter.
I think it makes a big difference. I think it makes a big difference, George. I wish it didn't. You talk about human nature. Human nature is I'm playing for a contract. And you go back in stats, and if you're a person, you're a fantasy player, and you're looking, look for the guy who's playing for a contract for next year. Not always.
So I will tell you, tune in late August when our Sportsnet fantasy guide comes out, as it does every year, because we actually have... Yeah, there you go. Well, it's relevant. We actually have a piece in it on this. Do players on their contract years perform better, and do players after signing large contracts perform worse? And the data is totally inconclusive, is what I will tell you. Some players do, some players don't, and there's no way to see it one way or the other. But the other thing I'll say is about incentives. Even a player signed for $10 million has incentives to perform. He has the incentive of not getting ripped in the media. He has the incentive of endorsement deals. He has the incentive of a Stanley Cup or a championship, the incentive of all-star teams. And like there's a million reasons to play hard, whether or not you just signed a deal or you're about to sign one. I'm sure money does matter to some players when their contracts are coming up, but you have to look really hard. And I think that's why they stick out so much, to find players who sign their big deals and totally mail it in.
Well, the funny thing with the Maple Leafs too, especially in this Austin Matthews situation, is not like money is ever an issue for the Maple Leafs. I mean, you look at Austin Matthews, and for like his Schedule A bonuses to kick in, he's going to need like numbers like 20 goals and like 60 points, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you're talking about a team who didn't even have a player with 50 points last season.
Well, and there's other factors like top 10 in scoring, top 5 in Hart Trophy voting.
But that's when you get deeper.
If you're a rookie and you're Austin Matthews and you can finish in the top 5 of Hart Trophy voting, I'd be very happy to give you another 800,000 or whatever the clause is. That's what I mean by the bonuses in terms of like as somebody. And plus, because of the collective bargaining agreement, let's remember, if this is another sport, if it's Major League Baseball draft, what do you think they do? You know what they do? It's bonus babies. It's especially if you're from Cuba or somewhere else.
Well, but
or,
let's talk about how these bonuses work, because what happens is you sign a guy to this contract and he gets, you know, the rookie salary, and that's all well and good. And he has these bonuses he can hit. And as soon as that contract is signed, that's out of team control. And those bonuses do have a real impact on your cap. And the problem is they don't come onto the cap until the year after in which you hit them. So, you know, I'm sure Leaf fans would be very happy if he finished in the top five in Hart Trophy voting. But let's say he hits all his bonuses for some reason. That's all of a sudden a big, not a big chunk, but a significant chunk off your salary cap for the next year. So you can't really plan for it. You can't build out. The more bonuses you give, the less certainty you have on your cap situation going forward.
Yeah, but if you're a team that's got the first overall pick, generally the least spend of the cap, but you're usually a crappy team. You're more concerned about the bottom of the cap than you are at the top. And even if he cashes every bonus, it's $2.85 million in a league with a $73 million salary cap.
Hey, so, that's Matt Martin money.
Yeah, well, maybe. But in terms of the overall, and that's why I think with the first-year players, they designed it that way. Because the expectation is, you know, again, the flip side is be like baseball. Be like baseball. Have $270 million payroll and a $70 million payroll, and the Maple Leafs could sign whoever they want. And then Austin Matthews could say, I want $15 million a year for 4 years and take it or leave it, or I'll go somewhere else. So there's both sides to it, but it's an interesting discussion. But do we like where the Leafs are going? Like,
yes.
Yeah? Like, I mean, no problem so far at all?
You'd have to nitpick, I think, over the last year. And I'm working on a piece about this for the magazine. Over the last year, pretty much everything for the Leafs has gone extremely well as could be hoped. I mean, they had arguably their worst season in franchise history, and everybody hailed it as a success, which is really the ultimate job you can pull. And I don't think, with the exception of, you know, the nitpicks, like I say, you can nitpick the Matt Martin signing. You know, now it makes you have to put a guy like Peter Holland on waivers who showed that he could be a successful third, fourth liner in the NHL. And, you know, those little moves make you sort of question, are they really focused only on skill? Are they still, you know, going to be those vestiges of the prior organization where, you know, grinding and mucking it up held sway? But, I mean, can you name a big thing the Leafs have gotten wrong over the last year?
And it's not just the ice. It's what Brendan Shanahan has done with the franchise as a whole, you know, from, you know, going with a total rebuild to surrounding yourself with, you know, a great front office, guys like Lou Lamoriello, Kyle Dubas, bringing in a coach like Mike Babcock. Like, there's been no misstep. Even something like the rebranding of the franchise, with, like, changing the logo and honoring the history. Like, it seems like everything Brendan Shanahan has touched has turned to gold so far.
And even Nylander last year. Nylander's a great example because, you know, they kept him down for most of the year, despite the fact that, you know, a lot of people said he was definitely ready to play in the NHL, but they didn't want to really expose him to that. They didn't want him to spend his entire year on a losing team. And they brought him up and, you know, he got some games in. He got to show that he could play at this level. And then just as he was about to get to the point where he would lose his rookie eligibility, they sent him back down. And it's just, it's that kind of not panicking, sticking to the plan, careful handling of young assets, that is the kind of thing that can pull a franchise out of the doldrums, which is what they need.
Which is really easy to do with Nylander. It'll be interesting to see how they approach it with Austin Matthews, because here's a first overall pick, a player whose skill level is higher than Nylander. So will they, is he the first line center tomorrow with next season with the Toronto Maple Leafs? Is he second, third? Like, how do they approach
that's
it with
an interesting
Austin
question. It's a very interesting question, because generally speaking, again, we go back to the prototypical number one. If number one overall pick generally goes into the lineup and they play the crap out of him, unless he gives them a reason not to. But in the case of the Leafs, where they are, plus the marketplace, plus everything else, how would you use Austin Matthews?
I mean, Austin Matthews was playing pro hockey last year. And not only was he playing pro hockey, he was also one of the best players at the World Championships. You know, I think he's proven that he can play a top-line role against that kind of competition. And like you said, unless he gives you a reason not to do it, I think you put him in the lineup and let him eat all those minutes.
It's still a big jump, though. And not only is it a big jump in terms of level of play, but you're doing it in Toronto, which I think makes it a lot tougher as well, because the spotlight is going to be huge. Like, it's one thing if the Leafs sign Steven Stamkos this offseason and it comes in and there's someone kind of takes some of that spotlight away, but Austin Matthews is going to be the talk when, you know, camp opens up for the Maple Leafs in the fall.
Well, we talked about the Blue Jays kind of having to ignore the fans. Here's the best thing I like about what the Maple Leafs have done. For the first time in my lifetime here, this organization doesn't give a flying you-know-what about the marketplace. Lou Lamoriello doesn't know what Twitter is. Mike Babcock has $50 million contract in his pants pocket, and he could care less. He has won a Stanley Cup. He has a great pedigree. For the first time, I think the organization has the cojones to just sit here and go, we have fired the fans and the media from running the team. We're not going to sign David Clarkson. We're not going to make panic moves. We're going to do it properly. And you know, they did put up, and now we're still in the honeymoon phase. It's a year, right?
This is what I'm saying. Wait till you see some real challenges.
If they finish 29th again this year and Matthews is slow out of the gate and they start, then maybe the – and let's not forget the old marketplace. They're coming off a disastrous year in terms of ratings and you know, the marketplace, everything else is doing it. So if they can stick it out longer, but so far, and that's all we can judge so far.
For sure.
They're acting like guys that listen.
100%.
They could be in Anaheim. They don't care.
But there's also a big difference between not caring and having it impact that player. And that's what I mean. Like it's something that Austin Matthews, you know, the team can say everything they want. They can try to like, you know, protect them and all that, but it's still going to have an impact, I think. Like, it's not like, you know, he was successful in Switzerland. He's just going to step in and do the same thing he did in the, you know, in that league. I feel like there is a big difference between caring and how it impacts that player.
There is. There's a difference in terms of, you know, the markets that he's playing in. But from everything we've seen of Austin Matthews, he's pretty polished. He's pretty game ready. And not only that, is he's spent, much like Connor McDavid has, spent an entire year being hailed as the surefire number one pick, right? Which itself comes with scrutiny and attention. And not only that, is he took it upon himself to be the first ever number one pick to not go to junior or whatever and to go and play professionally overseas. So, you know, there's a lot of things that show that this kid might be ready to just step in and do it. And I personally think he will. I think the biggest question for the Leafs next year in terms of the young kids is whether or not Mitch Marner plays with the Leafs next year, because he's outgrown the OHL, can't play in the AHL, desperately trying to get up to, what, 170 pounds so he can survive a shift in the NHL?
I'm also trying to get to 170, just the other way. It's a little different. Our goals are a little
pretty
different.
Pretty easy. Just grab some donuts. See, they're going to have protein shakes, the poor kid. Great point about Marner, because, again, that is going through, and that's an awkward one. Of all the decisions, you're right, because he'll go, if he goes back to the OHL, he'll score like 187 points, and that's nice, and win a scoring title or whatever. He's maxed out in that league, but he can't play in the American League. So there is one where, but I look at it. First, I expect him to make the team. I think he can play in the National Hockey League, despite the slight stature. And secondly, while Matthews is going, everyone's talking about Matthews, it makes it easier for Marner and Nylander too. Like we all say, well, Matthews is, these younger, and all the younger guys that come through don't have that scrutiny maybe because the number one overall pick is here. You know what? He's so large, Jordan, that he'll take the pressure off the other guys. That I like a lot.
Yeah, the thing about Marner is, and I mean, I agree with you, Raj, I don't doubt that Mitch Marner has the skill to play in the NHL. I mean, I think he's shown that he's got world-class hands and puck sense and vision and all those kind of things. I just worry about night after night. Like, 82 games is a long season, and somebody's going to take a crack at him right away. Yeah. And just because he's a hotshot kid, and I don't mean hotshot in that he's trying to show people up. I mean that his skill and his flair with the puck is what sets his game apart. So how do you counter that if you're an opposing team? You hit the 165-pound kid as hard as you can and hope he doesn't get back up.
Yeah, you're also spending a lot of time hitting Austin Matthews for the same kind of reason. Connor McDavid.
Austin Matthews is a bigger boy.
No, he's a bigger guy. He can take it physically. Don't deny that. But chasing after guys, kind of one of the things you see all the time. And this is a young team, and we'll see how it pans out. I still think Marner can be eased more into the lineup. There's not the big pressure to play him. He doesn't play all 82 games.
Play him on the power play.
Right, yeah, exactly. Especially reduces minutes. You know, let him work his way into the league.
Now, it's also my understanding that now he can't play for the Marlies unless it's on a conditioning stint. So I can fully see, you know, he kind of comes out of the gate, plays the first 8-9 games with the Maple Leafs.
I tweaked something.
Comes a healthy scratch. He's up in the press box for a little bit, and then they send him down to the AHL for a week or two on a conditioning stint just before the World Junior camp.
That sounds like a Lou Lamoriello move right there.
Lou's rules, yeah.
And listen, World Juniors is different than a whole season in the OHL. I'll take another World Junior term. I think anybody who's been in it and had success, they'll say, I'll go play the World Juniors. It's great.
Yeah, and they should send him back. I mean, they're not going to be, well, you know, unless something changes, they're not going to be a strongly contending team at that point in the season. And if you're not, and he's playing 12 minutes a night, mostly on the power play, why wouldn't you send him back? Because he'd likely be the leader and the captain of that team, and that's good experience too.
For sure.
Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello, Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis at Sportsnet Magazine live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Glad you're with us today, folks, as we talk about a Canadian institution in the Toronto Maple Leafs. And another Canadian institution is the RBC Canadian Open, which is on this weekend. A fascinating two rounds featuring Jared Dutoit, who is an amateur Canadian a shot away. As we head into moving day on Saturday, I think everybody in Canada is kind of hoping they don't move too much. This is what a story this is.
It is a fantastic story. I mean, in terms of Canadian news, and you know, here's a, you know, here's a player who's only played one other professional tournament in his career. So this is a massive step. Whether or not he can hang through the weekend will be a real test.
It'll be fun to see. I mean, I think this is what you're hoping to get if you're RBC, you're organizing the Canadian Open. This is what you're looking for. You have a local kid who's a feel good story, and you have Dustin Johnson at the top of the leaderboard, who I'm not entirely sure of how the world golf rankings work. I will admit that, but I know that he is really nipping on the heels of Jason Day right now, and if he can put this away while Day is way back in the pack, you might see the title swing on the Canadian Open win.
Well, I'll tell you something. If this guy even hangs in there, it'll be exciting. There were so many good stories. So I just want to mention him because I talked about him the other night, but there was another amateur. He's still in the field because he made the cut. Garrett Rank shot 69 in the opening round. He ballooned to a 75 yesterday, but he did make the cut, unlike other Canadians. We'll talk about in a second. He's an NHL official. Like, you talk about a story of a guy just coming from nowhere to Tuatu, but I mean, more of a prospect. This guy's tournament has been fantastic. Is it enough to really, though, kickstart the interest? Because the big name Canadians, the ones that we thought, I mean, last year, how excited were we watching a Canadian chase the title of the RBC Canadian Open? That was fantastic. Does the tournament need that, or is it good enough that Dustin Johnson's at the top of the leaderboard or Jason Day?
I think it does in terms of local interest. I think you're certainly going to spark, you know, the Canadian fan base and the casual golf fan. You know, if there's a Canadian in contention, I think that's going to pull those people in. But just to play devil's advocate, I wonder how good it is for the Canadian Open overall to have, like, you know, if this Canadian amateur, you know, Dutoit goes on and he wins the tournament, is it good for the Canadian Open? Is it good for a tournament that's trying to be the fifth major? I mean, to me, if, you know, if I'm a golfer on the PGA Tour and I look at the Canadian Open, I see Dustin Johnson winning it. To me, that adds a little bit more cachet to the tournament. I feel like if I see a Canadian amateur's winning it, I'm thinking, well, is this a really tournament I need to be at?
But if you're a professional golfer, you're also watching what's happening at that tournament. So you would watch Dutoit outdueling theoretically Dustin Johnson down the stretch, which is a great story for golf, right? That's a head-to-head, one-on-one, etc., etc. And I mean, in terms of star power, the Canadian Open is always going to be a little challenged by that, just because it comes right after the British Open and a lot of guys are there. But if you have a great Canadian amateur, a few really good Canadian golfers in the field, and you have the number one and number two players in the world in Jason Day and Dustin Johnson, like, that's a good field. And one of them's in the lead and he's being chased down by a Canadian. That, to me, is like a perfect storm.
It's not quite the same analogy, guys, but if I can bring up the Rogers Cup, something near and dear to me, I love that event, and it's a terrific thing. If Djokovic plays Milos Raonic in the final, that is a wet dream for the organizers.
This would be when, like Djokovic playing Dancevich in the final, though. That's what we're talking about here. This
okay,
is
that's
not
even
yeah,
better.
This is not DeLatin DJ going down
it's
the stretch.
True. It's not this David is, Hearn. Yeah. This is some guy who nobody ever heard of. Imagine a playoff with these two guys, like a rank amateur Canadian against Johnson. So I think it's so far so good. It's interesting. I did an interview with the tournament chairman, Mr. McLaughlin, I think Thursday's show here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, maybe Wednesday, doesn't matter. And he brought up an interesting thing. Some of the PGA players who were at the tournament last year, because they're always trying to get feedback, right? And they know the challenges. The Open Championship, they got to fly from Britain. This year, the Olympics. There's so many competing things and tournaments. And they talked to the players, and some of the guys even said, and I think Dustin Johnson was one of them, defending champion, or one of the champions, won this thing before, sits back, Jason Day. They sit back and they go, you know, this is, looks like any PGA stop. Why don't you do more to make it more Canadiana, make it a national champion? And back in the day, guys, you guys are young, but back in the day, this tournament was like a fifth major.
Fifth major.
It was like the Canadian Open. It was big, and they kind of lost that thing. Now, credit to them. They had red and white day on Friday. The players, actually, a lot of the players wore red and white yesterday, even the non-Canadians, just to show their support. The link to that, I think, is important. I don't know how you do that, but it's got to be more branded as Canada's thing, guys. I think, you know, Milos is helping to do that in tennis. And if a Canadian can break through and win, Mike Weir almost, when Mike Weir won the Masters, remember what that did for golf in the country? So let's
hope. Yeah, it's a chicken and the egg thing.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, if more great golfers start coming and more Canadians start competing, the interest level will rise. And by definition, right, the only real way to make a tournament like the Canadian Open feel less like a PGA event and more like a real major championship is having more fans come and having those fans be really into it and having there be some really exciting moments with huge galleries. And in order to do that, you have to get the field there first. So, you know, it's always going to be a struggle.
It also helps when Tiger Woods is hitting one of his signature shots on the 18th hole. Well, the bunker, you know, it's
if people still go to that bunker and they just look and they remember Tiger's shots and how significant that was, yeah, you got to have the world's top player, which leads again to the potential of this final round being pretty good because Dustin Johnson's a big name. And if somebody else, one of the other big guys, can charge along with the Canadian, then it's great. But you do need that cachet. And that was the Rogers Cup. What a decimating week for them last week when Nadal and Federer and Andy Murray all pull out at the same time. At least they still have the number one player. And I think it's the same thing for the Canadian Open. And you're right in terms of, like, it's not always golfers sitting back going, oh, I don't want to go to the Canadian Open. Some guy I never heard of won it before. It's like, no, they want to go because it's a great event. The atmosphere is terrific. The crowds are good. It's a good course. And Glen Abbey, for all its, you know, naysayers, and I know there was going to be a condo project down there, is really one of the legendary courses of all time. And if you're a golfer and you're a golf fan, I really hope the event takes off. Because I tell you what, I still see it. At least in my eyes, it should be more of a big event. Fifth major. Why not?
Well, you can hope for it. I mean, you can hope that the Rogers Cup becomes the fifth tennis major.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
It would be great. Yeah, nobody's going to complain about it in this city anyway. But I think that the Canadian Open is just fine. I'm not complaining about it. Like, it's a fun week of golf. Christina Rutherford is up there covering it for us on the website. And, you know, she's tweeting some pictures of it. And it just looks like people are having a great time. You can get real close to the golfers, too, which I know if you're a big fan is one of the things that you want to do. I got buddies who are huge golf fans. And that's all they talk about is how close you can get to them when you walk the course.
I have been to both the Canadian Open and the Rogers Cup. And your buddies are right. It is really exciting to see these athletes close up, even more so than when you go to a hockey game or a baseball game. Literally, Rogers Cup, you walk by the fence and you could literally reach over sometimes and touch a guy.
Canadian Open, they'll shake your hand.
Exactly, and the golfers are real terrific, too. There's great ambassadors there. Dustin Johnson is tied with Luke List at 7 under par. They tee off at 135 today. And Gerard Duttat, the story, goes at 115, 6 under, also at 50 at 6 under. John Rahm and Kelly Kraft. Moving day at the Canadian Open. Should be a lot of fun. And Derek Father off early today with a 65, so he moves into contention as well at 5 under par. Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie. Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello with me. Coming up, one of the reasons the challenge of the Canadian Open this year is the Olympics. And the Olympics have been wrought with a lot of players saying no in both golf and in tennis. But the amateur athletes have no problems playing in Rio at all. And will there be any Russians there at all, period? What does the IOC do about that? We'll talk about that next on Sportsnet Magazine Live. Roger Lajoie, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine. Here's Dave Zarum.
Everyone stand up, please. Wow. What was that, 100 shot rally?
Not quite 100, but close. It's considered the greatest rally in tennis history, a 54-shot epic between Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic at the 2013 US Open Final. Djokovic won the point, and it's the perfect display of why it's so hard to beat the world's number one. Since then, he's only gotten better. Before Wimbledon this year, he'd won 4 straight slams and 6 of the last 7. In an era featuring, in some order, the 3 greatest players of all time, Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal, Djokovic cemented his status as tennis's top dog. Federer reached the pinnacle of the sport through Swiss precision and the best forehand around. Nadal through sheer power. But for Djokovic, the key to his success has been his defense and an ability to cover the court, particularly from side to side along the baseline, like nobody before. It may be a cliche, but defense wins titles, and Djokovic has proven it throughout his career. Combine his defense with the best fitness of any athlete on tour and a total command of the inner game, and it's why, when all is said and done, Novak Djokovic will go down as the greatest to have ever played the game.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine. Available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie, along with Jordan Heath, Rawlings, Gary Mello, in for Ben Ennis this week. Great to be with you. It is a big decision time for a lot of athletes and people. First, we'll get to the IOC in a second, what they do with Russia. But it's also a decision time for golfers, tennis players, and amateur athletes, too. But in particular, it seems more of a problem for professional athletes of whether they should be at Rio and playing in the Olympics. It's kind of a hot topic button issue, guys, but I'm curious your thoughts. First of all, let's stay with golf because we just talked about the RBC Canadian Open. Should golfers even be in the Olympics? And if the top players aren't going to come, if the idea is to showcase golf and your top guys aren't going to go, sorry, I'm kind of missing the point.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's been one of the more terrible stories I thought going into this Rio Olympics is with the athletes dropping out is the golfers. You know, here is, you know, 112-year absence from the Olympic Games. You fight to get it back to the Olympic Games, and then all your best players start dropping out like flies. Sorry, bad pun, but not intentional. But it's a terrible story, and you don't want to begrudge these guys for doing it, because if I were in their shoes, I'm thinking, do I want to go somewhere with the, you know, the Zika virus and the poop water and all that stuff? Like, I don't know if I would want to go.
I don't want to go to Rio, by the way. If they sent me, I would not go.
Well, your golf game's terrible, Jordan, so don't worry. There's no,
no, but he doesn't want to go because he doesn't like it there.
Yeah.
What about the golfers, though? Do you think, like, I mean, that's got to be a downer for the industry of golf is, like, let's display the Olympics and the best guys don't want to play.
Well, I think, yeah, the best guys is a good point because the best women golfers in the world will be there representing their countries.
And Canada's going to win the gold, maybe.
We have a shot. It'll be great. Pretty interesting. But I think, in general, there's a lot of really good golfers in the world. And to say that, you know, because a handful of the really top players are not going there, that this event is going to be a failure, let them get on the course. Let's see how it goes. You know, once guys start playing for their country, you know, some fun things can happen. And do I blame those guys for not coming? Absolutely not.
Well, while the Olympics are on, this is one thing. It doesn't matter. We saw it with Beijing in particular, all the controversy of what was going on in China before. Once the Olympics are on, even the Pan Am Games in Toronto, for God's sakes, for the 2 weeks it was on, it was like we were doing shows. Oh, it's great. I went to the event. It was fantastic. And it all gets forgotten. But the core issue of professional athletes, both golf and tennis, is a little different, obviously, than the amateur golfers. And yeah, the quality of golf in the Olympics would be great. The quality of tennis will still be great, even with some of the best players taking a pass on that. But even just to kind of force feed the issue, of course, golf and tennis are great sports, but they have their own thing now. Does it take away from amateur athletes the rest of it? Do we need more sports in the Olympics? Do we need golf? And again, I go back, if the top guys aren't going to play for the gold medal, what's the point?
No, and that's just it. I mean, and you haven't seen many amateur athletes pull out. Like, you're seeing, you know, all these, like, professional golfers and tennis players pulling out. Well, when's the last time you saw a swimmer say he's not going to Rio?
Because, well, because if a swimmer doesn't go to the Olympics, then there's nothing else on his calendar.
But that speaks to how great the games are and how important it is for these amateur athletes. So I think, to Roger's point, it's like, if you're going to let these professional athletes in, the least you could do is show up. And you know what I mean? I feel like it's a form that's so important to the amateur athletes. And by these professional golfers and tennis players just dropping out, I think it's a bit of a slap in the face.
I think this is somewhat of a unique Olympics, just in
for sure.
The social unrest in Brazil and the, you know, concerns over Zika and, as you mentioned, the water.
But don't we get these storylines around every
I think it's worse. I think it's worse
part?
This time. Yeah. I know we do. I know,
I
like,
mean,
you know,
before Sochi was bad. It's like there's always something, it seems.
Yeah, there always will be something because everybody likes to see. I mean, remember, there was not going to be enough snow for the Vancouver Olympics, right? There's always something with the Olympics, but I think it's on another level. We have, you know, there are police officers standing in the airport saying, you're not going to be safe here because we haven't been paid. Like, that's on a whole nother level from the usual pre-Olympics complaints and worries and that kind of stuff. So I think it's different, but also as a fan, as somebody who's going to watch these Olympic Games when I have the time, I want to see the best athletes in the world playing those sports. I don't particularly care as a fan whether they're amateur or professional. I want to see this stuff played at the highest level. And yeah, it's tough that the best golfers aren't going to be there. But you know what? You're talking about making the Olympics for amateurs again. Do you want to go back to seeing U.S. college kids play the basketball? Because I personally enjoy watching those great American teams.
Right, but all the guys, not all of them, some guys pass, but most of them go. But your point about this Olympics being different is very true. I just wonder, because we went through it here, the SARS situation in 2003. Now, that was bad. There's no question. I hope I got this right, I think 44 Canadians actually died of SARS. So I'm not belittling it, but the rest of the world stayed away from this city because of hysteria over it, and we all lived through it. I said that on the air the other night and said, no, 44 people didn't die from SARS. And, well, yeah, they did. Maybe it's 44, maybe it's 45. I've got that number pretty close. So the perception of the world, and I see a tweet and someone says, look, here's a shot at the airport and somebody's doing this, or look, I just wonder that. And then when the show comes to town, do you really think, and I hope I'm not jinxing it, that something bad's going to happen there? Where do bad things happen when nobody's looking? I just don't know how anybody could attack an Olympic Games with the securities there. And again, I knock on wood, I certainly hope I'm not jinxing, but you know what I mean? So is it really that bad? And I just remember the SARS thing, and I'm a friend of mine in the United States, I'm never going to Toronto again. That place is ridiculous. You'd be all dying of SARS. In fact, remember they tweeted pictures of a sold-out Sky Dome, or Rogers Center, because they wanted to see, look, everybody's actually, what, the whole world thought, right, Toronto was falling apart.
But it doesn't matter so much whether or not anything happens when the game's actually on. The fact is, when we're talking about athletes pulling out of the games, is they're pulling out because they're worried that something could. They're pulling out because I can't remember whether it was Jordan Spieth or Rory McIlroy who said, you know, I'm in the process of about to start a family, you know, and I don't want to get this virus. And I wouldn't blame anybody who's participating in a water sport if they looked at the results of those water tests and said, you know what, I don't want to put my health at risk. And I understand that it's more difficult for an amateur athlete to do that than a professional athlete who already has millions and has a game to go back to. But, you know, you're not asking them. It's easy for us to sit here and say, well, you know, probably nothing's going to happen. Probably it's going to be fine. And none of the three of us are going to Rio, so we don't have to really embrace exactly what it means if it's not going to be fine.
Would you
so
have
I don't
a problem
begrudge
going?
It at all.
If you
yes,
guys were,
I
yeah,
would.
You would?
Yeah,
would
I don't
you?
Want to go.
Sure.
I think so.
Yeah, I'd go. Just based on the fact that for the Olympic Games, but I do see the concerns, and certainly the pregnancy part of Zika virus is there. But then I talked to another guy the other night, says it's the winter there. There's not nearly as many. Yeah. So you go back. So that's what I mean by hysteria of information. And then sometimes I wonder the information, is it coming from, as we did see, 100 doctors who got together and said, I would not have the Olympic Games this year? Or is it coming from isolated tweets that get retweeted from a bunch of people about one thing that they saw down the street that leads to that? It's
well,
a tough decision.
100 doctors is. Sure. Is yeah.
No, it was impressive.
there's not a lot to
But if you've talked to doctors,
that.
A lot of doctors will give you a different. I can find 100, it'll tell you no problem, too. It's almost like anything in terms of any walk of life. Lawyers, doctors, I'll find you another 100 who say it. So it's a difficult issue. But health concerns aside, another issue facing this Olympics is, what do you do with Team Russia? And we've talked about, you know, the athletes backing away, mostly professional tennis players and golfers, because they don't want to be involved in it, or for whatever reason. But even the amateur athletes, not nearly as much. They're all in. They want to play. The Russian athletes who have trained for a lot of years want to play. But the widespread doping situation that is in Russia now leads to a decision, never mind the track and field team. Do you just throw out every Russian athlete? And that decision's got to be made. It better be made fast, because the Olympics start August the 5th. If you're the guy making the call, would you do it?
I think you have to. I think you're at a point now where you have to send that message. You know, it's really different. It's not like you have a bunch of athletes who are picking and choosing, to be doping and using performance-enhancing drugs. We're talking about state-sponsored thing happening here. Not just, like, the actual process, but the cover-up as well. So I think at some point you need to send a message to the Russian Federation by kicking them out. If you want to kind of maintain, preserve, or I guess restore some of that integrity with the Olympic Games, you cannot justify this. You need to throw them all out.
Yeah, and I mean, I hate to hold up the NCAA as a shining example of how you do it, but at the same time, you know, innocent athletes are going to get caught by this ban if that's what happens to Russia at the games, and that's regrettable. But in the same way that the next generation of freshmen are also sometimes unfairly punished by NCAA sanctions, but in order to keep the programs in line, that's what you have to do. And I think that if you just started then going through and picking and choosing who tested positive or who had doubts or whatever, then you're not punishing the people who are actually responsible.
Like, if you start picking and choosing where you dole out justice, let's just say a Russian gymnast who's been clean and got to the Olympics the right way and wins the gold medal. Like, that's fantastic for that athlete. But can you imagine the second they step on the podium and that Russian flag is lowered and they play that Russian anthem? The optics of that are terrible.
And how does the silver medalist feel in that situation, knowing that the person standing ahead of them having a gold medal, or even the person who finished in fourth, and the reason that they didn't get a medal at the Olympics was because somebody from a program that has been convicted of doping offenses is standing at the top of the podium.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of amateur athletes are in the same kind of mix. You know, sometimes Jordan, Gary, I've talked to some and they'll say that, and I believe them, they say they don't want to win a medal that is somehow tainted because the country is not there for whatever reason. Now, yes, if it's a cheater, of course. But again, I go back, I would do it. I got to get off the fence. I would do it too. I would throw them all out. I guess the only thing that's really the reservation for me, is it not too late? It's like a week. When are they supposed to be there?
Yeah. Well,
like,
hey, if some athletes can pull out of Rio now, then you can pull a team out,
but
too.
But a guy's all set to go in. A week prior to the Olympics, you tell him, yeah, I know you've trained for 4 years, but the federation's all messed up. We just found, and I know nothing you do about the timing when you find out about it. It's just, it's so bloody close. If I was an Olympic athlete and I was told you're not going to the Olympics 6 months before, well, I got my head around it. I got some time to, I don't want to use the word grieve. It's not life and death, but I mean, you know what I'm saying?
You have time to cope with it for sure. But what also makes it difficult, I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and say that is the right thing to do. But there's a lot of politics involved in this as well. And for the IOC to make a move like that, you're biting the hand that feeds you because, you know, we just saw Sochi games where there's been a lot of reports that the IOC got a lot of money for. So to then turn around and kick them out of an entire Olympic Games would be a pretty bold move by the IOC.
Politics involved in the Olympics
and
in
money,
Russia. Yeah.
And money as well. That'd be surprising. Why do you think golf and tennis is in the Olympics to start with? It's a nice little more revenue for the IOC. Well, it's hard to defend them. All right, we got a few more minutes. 45 more athletes, including 23 medalists from the 08 Beijing Games, were caught for doping this week. So we see the widespread scandal. We talk about it all the time. We're talking about banning athletes from the Olympics. Why is it then that the Olympics still remain such an enormously popular event? I know why. It's the nationalism. But how has it managed to survive as well as it has, despite the fact that apparently just about everybody's on some kind of juice?
Well, and I think, you know, there's that, and there's also a bigger issue of the fact that, you know, we're kind of seeing more and more how difficult it is to kind of put all that money in Olympic Games. You know, Stephen Brunton had a great column in Sportsnet magazine on sportsnet.ca recently how this kind of might be the end of, like, the big oversized games. You know, not only is it difficult to pull off, but the effects that it has on the country afterwards. Like, you know, we're seeing photos of all the issues in Brazil right now. And, you know, there's photos of homeless people sleeping on the side of the road with a big Olympic banner in the background kind of thing. And, you know, with the slogan, the world has changed and all this stuff. And forgetting the fact that there are important issues that are kind of being ignored here in Brazil to put all this money towards the Olympics. So it goes beyond that even.
Yeah, not a lot of smart, responsible countries lining up to host the games now, nor probably in the foreseeable future, unless you already have the infrastructure in place, right? I mean, there was talk about Canada applying to host another games in Calgary, where all that Olympic equipment is already there and already ready to go. But, you know, for me, the Olympics is a spectacle, and it's something that shows up, you know, once every couple of years. It only takes a couple of weeks, in the same way that people who don't, like myself, who don't ordinarily follow college basketball can get into the March Madness tournament. You know, there's something about taking an event and cramming an entire season or an entire event into 2 weeks and heavily televising it and heavily promoting it that really encourages fans to buy in. Because trust me, 90% of the sports that will be competed at these Olympic Games, I don't care about at all, but I'll watch some of them anyway.
Oh, that's true of everybody. That's so true. And listen, I do not like the Olympics. I've said that many times, but while they're on, it's a spectacle. You can't take your eyes off. It doesn't seem to matter what the difference is made. Flip side too, guys, and which is a good thing, is when you look at Canadian athletes now who are really how far this country's come. I'm of a vintage. Montreal Olympics, 1976, Greg Joy won a silver medal on the last day, which was the only medal Canada won at that Olympics in 19. Think about that, 40 years ago. Now we have Calgary first, because Calgary is great too. Vancouver, over the top success. The number of medals Canada continues to come in. We've gone from an also, remember, when's the last time anyone talked about personal best? We used to talk about that all the time. Well, you know what? He gave his personal best. Nobody even looks at personal best. Did you win a medal or not? There's good and bad that comes with that, but my God, have Canadian athletes ever come a long way?
The standards have been raised so high over the last couple of decades, and it's to the credit of these athletes who, you know, have made us care about events that we probably wouldn't. And I mean, and now Canadians are competing to win on the biggest stage. Do I think Andre DeGrasse is a favorite in the 100 meters? Not as long as Usain Bolt is anywhere near full health, but the fact that there's, you know, twice now in the last 20 years, there's been a Canadian sprinter who is a legit threat to run faster than anybody else in the world. That's something that Canada hasn't had, you know, going back to the beginning of the Olympics.
Fantastic. It is incredible. And it's a source of pride. And I think it's a reason why we're more interested in the Olympics than ever, despite all the doping scandals. Guys, I hate to tell you this, but speaking of doping scandals, the show is over. You got to now pee in a bottle. They've started a new thing here on Sportsnet Magazine Live. So do the drug test. I hope you pass.
I've got a Russian doctor, so I'm not sweating this at all.
Oh, good line.
I have a sample already prepared that definitely came from me.
And yeah. You put it through the hole.
Plug
in the
mouse
wall.
Holes. Yeah.
Way to go. Gentlemen, great to be with you. A lot of fun here in the last 2 hours. Jordan Heath Rawlings, Gary Mello, thank you very much, guys. Terrific job. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis. Terrific job by Emil Delich and Mike Sesney, producer and technical director. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. Stick around. I'll lead you into Blue Jay baseball. That's coming up shortly. You've been listening to Sportsnet Magazine Live with Roger Lajoie, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Gary Mello right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.